I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings,
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just visit our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner, or you can check out the link below in the description. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we're going to have part three of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we're talking about the history of the Mr. Olympia contest, because this year, 2024, will mark the 60th Mr. Olympia contest that started way back in 1965. So for the last couple of shows, Jerry and I have been going over the different decades of the Mr. Olympia. We started, of course, with 1965 and the Bud Parker era, where Bud Parker was the promoter of Mr. Olympia from 1965 to 69. And then we covered Arnold years. And then last week, we covered the 1980 and 81 Olympia, as well as all the competitions that were held in Columbus, Ohio from 1976 to 1979, when Franco won and Frank Zane won three Mr. Olympias. And also we talked about Chris Dickerson winning in 1982. And Samir Banute winning in 1983. So we're going to pick up from there. And in this week's episode, we're going to talk to Jerry about 1984, when Lee Haney won, and his reign from 1984 to 1991. And then after that, it was Dorian Yates from 1992 to 1997. And then Ronnie Coleman won eight Mr. Olympias. He tied Lee Haney's record from 1998 to 2005, I believe. And then after that, we'll talk about Phil Heath and Jay Cutler and all the other current Mr. Olympias up until today. All right. Hope you guys are doing good out there. I did get another email that I'm going to read in a minute. Before I do that, though, I want to tell you to check out my YouTube channel. I've been really working hard putting up some videos, put up a couple of videos this week. I'm promoting my online fitness business and my website, johnhansenfitness.com. So if any of you guys out there are looking for a nutrition and workout program to get in shape, just check out my website. I've got 3-month programs, 1-month programs, 6-month programs. So we got everything up there. And if you check out my YouTube channel, I've been posting more videos addressed to the fitness concern about getting in shape. I just did one this week on seeing your abs over 50. If you're over 50, how to see your abs again. So I got that one up, and I got some more coming up this week. I also put up some Bodybuilding Legends videos. We had the one, part one of our interview with Jerry. That is now up. So check that out, even if you heard the podcast. So we've got some pictures up there. So that makes it a little more entertaining. And I also put up one we did earlier in the year in January when we did our end of the year review with Jerry. This was 1993 in review. This was part two. Me and Jerry covered all the pro shows from 1993, including the Arnold Classic and the Ironman Pro Invitational, which were won by Flex Wheeler in his pro debut. And then also talked about the Night of the Champions and the Chicago Pro Show and the Pittsburgh Pro Show, all three of which were won by Porter Cottrell. So I got that up now as well. So check out my YouTube channel under my name, John Hansen. All right. And at the end of our interview with Jerry, because this one's kind of a short one again, I think this is about 40 minutes, so it's not our typical hour-long show, I am going to read a special article. This is the Once Upon a Time in Australia article that really is supposed to tell the real story of the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And Michael Ekomides, one of our great listeners and Patreon subscriber himself, he sent this to me with his email, which I'm going to read in a second. So I know a lot of people have been asking about this. I think when I did my interview with Roger Walker way back, God, that's got to be, when did we do that? I think that we did that before we even started the podcast. So it's got to be like 10 years ago. Roger was telling me to check out that article because he said that really tells the true story. And I could not locate it at the time, but now it's been circulating on Facebook and around the internet. I do have it here, and I'm going to read it for you guys as soon as we get done with our interview with Jerry Branum, where we talk about the history of the Mr. Olympia. Michael also sent me an email, so I want to read that for you guys. He says, "Hey, John, I hope all is well. As always, enjoying the podcast, and I thought I would drop you a note. Firstly, in response to a negative email you received a couple weeks ago, your podcast is a perfect diamond in an internet full of cubic zirconias. Nothing comes close to what you do. As for the magazine readings, these are a welcome and essential part of your podcast, either when complimenting an interview or the focus of the podcast. The magazines have always been an integral part of what made the golden years of bodybuilding so great. Yes, your interviews are the highlight of the show, and I look forward to them when you're fortunate enough to get a guest. However, it must be remembered that in your absence, you have an archive of hundreds of previous interviews that we can access at any time. Just in the last week, I've re-listened to your interviews with Roger Callard, Chris Dickerson, and Roy Duvall. I think enough said on this topic. I've really enjoyed your first two Mr. Olympia history podcasts with Jerry Branum. Well done to you both. I would like to comment on a couple of the events. Firstly, the 1979 Mr. Olympia. After considering what I have read, heard, and seen of the event, I clearly have Frank Zane a step or two ahead of the competition. I believe the two weight classes in 1979 assisted Mike Mentzer. As you know, Mentzer led Zane 300 points to 299 points going into the pose down, well ahead of Boyer Coe on 290. I have to think this is only the result of the comparative competition in each class. Zane's class ran deep as he was up against nine other competitors, including Coe, Robinson, Dickerson, Padilla, Beckles, and Platts. Mentzer had only four other competitors in his class, Walker and Tinnerino being his closest competition. Callender, from recollection, was injured, and Bob Birdsong had not competed since 1975. I believe the scoring has a direct correlation to the depth of competition you face. Once the top six were compared, the gap between Zane and Mentzer was clear to see. Zane got five of the judges' votes, with Coe and Mentzer receiving a vote each. I think Coe got closer to Zane than anyone else, but ultimately Zane was a clear and deserving winner. No dispute in my eyes here. However, there was controversy in 1980. What I consider the greatest Olympia of them all. What a field. 16 of the greatest physiques of all time on one stage. Sure, there were some omissions. Robbie Robinson, Sergio Oliva, Serge Nubre, and Calvin Skalek had fallen out with the Weeders, whilst Franco Colombo was injured and Lou Ferrigno was focused on the Hulk TV series. Despite this, nothing since or before has come close. Now for the competition, or should I say show. I think I've read all the contest reports published in the magazines of the day. The majority of them had their own bias or agenda. I have seen all available footage of the event. It's only through an amalgamation of all of this that the picture becomes clearer. In my eyes, there were eight competitors fighting out for the top three spots. Schwarzenegger, Dickerson, Zane, Coe, Mentzer, Walker, Callender, and Tinnerino were all in the mix. As for Schwarzenegger being judged the winner, this is very debatable, and all the current noise about Mentzer being the uncrowned champion is definitely off the mark. I've seen unpublished photos of Schwarzenegger and Mentzer on either side of Roger Walker. Trust me, in these photos, your eyes are drawn to Walker all day, every day. If you scratch the surface just a little bit around the circumstance leading up to the show and some key decisions made during the show, you start to see that there is the distinct possibility that the deck was stacked in Schwarzenegger's favor. I have only to direct you to the anonymous piece of bodybuilding literature aptly titled Once Upon a Time in Australia to start to paint a picture of what was not right. It draws on a number of events between Arnold Schwarzenegger, Paul Graham, and Joe Weider that could have theoretically led to Australia being rewarded the Olympia and Arnold ultimately being granted the title. In conjunction with this, a number of key events that occurred at or just before the show lead you to think that all was not right. Bill Pearl supposedly removed himself from the judging panel due to his association with Chris Dickerson as he coached Chris at his Oregon ranch in the lead up to the event. This may have been a diplomatic way out for Bill as he may have gotten wind of what was to come and wanted no part of it. This definitely played into Schwarzenegger's hands, as Bill was quoted in the aftermath of the show as saying, "I sure as hell wouldn't have picked Arnold." Then there was the little-known but highly impactful decision to swap out the nominated Australian judge. The highly credentialed and experienced Peter McCarthy was replaced at the last minute for the less experienced associate of Paul Graham and an acquaintance of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Brendan Ryan, who just 2 months earlier had been stood down as a national judge. The official reason for the change being that Peter McCarthy arrived late to the judges' meeting and had to be replaced. My understanding is that Peter was not formally advised of the meeting, and if had not notified by an acquaintance while the meeting was in progress, he would have missed it altogether. He did attend a portion of the meeting, as I've seen photos to validate this. However, this was not sufficient for him to hold his place amongst the judges. Very strange indeed. If we examine the scorecards, Brendan Ryan was one of only two judges to award Schwarzenegger the perfect 60, Albert Busack being the other. But the difference between Busack and Ryan's scorecards becomes compelling when you look at how the rest of the competitors were judged. Busack also awarded Frank Zane the perfect 60, while he had given scores of 59 to Dickerson, Coe, Walker, and Callender. Brendan Ryan, on the other hand, had Frank Zane a distant second with a score of 57, and Dickerson in third with 56. Then there was the rest of the competition with scores lower than that. Brendan Ryan had Schwarzenegger not only winning, but dominantly winning. His scorecard definitely provided Arnold a nice little buffer should it be needed when the final scores were tallied. Finally, we come to the judge's chairman, the stern but fair Dennis Stallard. He had the duty of controlling and providing direction to the competitors on stage. Whilst discharging his duties, he threatened to disqualify Arnold for not completing the mandatory pose request and generally disregarding direction. Shortly after this, Dennis was replaced and removed from his duties, not to be seen again. Definitely a series of fortunate events that helped the Austrian Oak be awarded his seventh Olympia title. Food for thought. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing, Michael Eagle-Meetings. Man, was that a great letter or what? That was great, Michael. Thank you. Let me comment on some of these things. I was at the 79 Olympia, and I agree with you. I thought Zane was a deserving winner. I've had a lot of people ask me, because a lot of Mike Mentzer stories have been going around over the last few decades, especially now. Mike Mentzer is super popular, especially with younger people, which is very interesting. But he's on the internet a lot. He's on YouTube a lot. There's a lot of stories about him, and a lot of people feel that Mike should have beat Zane in the overall because, as Michael mentioned, he scored a 300 in the prejudging and Zane only scored 299. But what Mike said was very, very important here is that it was judged separately in classes. And as Michael said, the under 200 pound class was much bigger and it was much more competitive than the over 200 pound class. And actually, every year I saw the contest, 77, 78, and 79, the under 200 pound class was always bigger than the over 200. So that's why in 1980, a lot of the competitors said, let's just have one class, because what was happening was they would take the top three from the under 200 pound class and the top three from the over 200 pound class and then bring them together for the top six pose down. But if you had four or five really good guys in the under 200 pound class, only three of them were going to make the pose down. And sometimes that fourth or fifth place guy was better than the guys who were like second or third in the over 200 pound class. So you didn't really have the top six guys. You had the top three from each class. So that's why I think this is a good point. When Mentzer and Zane stood next to each other, Zane was better. He was harder. He was more finished. And I thought it was the right decision as well. I didn't think it was a controversial decision. And I don't think Mentzer should have won. And as he said, he got five of the first place votes out of seven judges. So that's pretty definitive when they were finally compared to each other. And that was very interesting about Brendan Ryan. I knew Brendan, and I knew that story about Brendan Ryan replacing Peter McCarthy. And I think there was an article in Iron Man that said that if Peter McCarthy would have judged, because I think he did sit there and judge, but his scores weren't used. And somebody found his scores and they said if his scores would have been used instead of Brendan Ryan, Chris Dickerson would have won the Olympia. And that's very interesting how he marked the other guys way down. Because like I've gotten in arguments with people who've said, well, you know, Mike Mentzer wasn't even close. He was fifth place in that contest. But that's because the judges marked Mentzer down. There was a lot of judges who were friends of Arnold who marked Mike lower than he probably should have been, even if he shouldn't have deserved to win. That's why he was fifth. So that makes a big difference. And you notice if you ever examine the score sheets from the 1981 Olympia, it's the same thing. There was a couple judges in there that were very much in favor of Franco. And even though some of the other judges didn't mark Franco in first, they still placed him high enough with a 19 or an 18. And then there was a couple other judges who put Franco, gave him a perfect score. And then, as in 1980, they marked the other guys way down. Like Danny Padilla got really low scores, and that's why he was in fifth place. So that's very, very interesting. So really good stuff. That was a great email. So thank you for sending that. And thanks for the support of the show, as always. All right, guys, if you guys want to send me an email for this week's show, just send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com and I'll read your email on the air. I appreciate the emails that you guys are sending. All right, so that's all I got for our opening. So let's go to part three of our interview with Jerry Branum. where we talk about the history of the Mr. Olympia contest. And we're going to pick it up in the year that Lee Haney won his first Mr. Olympia in 1984. Here we go. All right, let's go to the Lee Haney year. So this was from 1984 to 1991. And Lee Haney came in, his first Mr. Olympia was 83, where he took third. But then in 84, he was so much improved. Right. And he just dominated. So now, this was the first time, I guess, since Arnold, where we had a guy who was a big guy, but he was just such a great bodybuilder. He was so dominant that nobody could touch him. And right. He beat Arnold's record, and he won it 8 times in a row.
Right.
But it was just a genetic freak. So now, they talk about when bodybuilding got big, you know, when it turned the corner, yeah. And it was just all about size. But I don't think, I mean, Lee Haney was big, but he was more than just big. He had great symmetry because he had that super small waist.
Right.
Plus, he put it all together. He had really no weak points. His posing was really good. It showed off his physique really well. He was always in shape. He had great stage presence. He was always smiling. You know, so he was a complete bodybuilder from head to toe, and he had all the aspects of a great bodybuilder.
Right, right. Well, I covered the latter years of, let's say, the reign of Lee Haney. I was out of the coast, and I could tell you, I don't know if it's reflected in the magazines back then, but Lee was very dominant.
Yes.
For the last couple of years of his, let's say, Mr. Olympia reign, he was considered almost unbeatable. I mean, I remember
pretty much every year, right, Jer?
Yeah, every year. Well,
every year he won.
In 87 in Gothenburg, Sweden, when he won, I was there. In fact, I remember they put me at a hotel away from everyone. I don't know why. And I happened to be in the same hotel as Lee. And we had breakfast a couple of times together. We went to the gym together. But I remember that, you know, you could see that everybody already assumed that he was winning.
Yeah.
But those are the other guys. Hope to place high, but nobody really believed they were going to beat Haney.
Yeah.
I think I told you the story when I went to a local gym there in Gothenburg with Lee. We went to take Lee wasn't going to train.
Yeah.
He went to use the tanning bed, believe it or not.
Right, right.
But I wanted to get a workout in, and it just happens that all the Mr. Olympia competitors were training in the gym that day when we walked in.
Yeah.
And it was just like it was like something out of a movie. Because, they're all working out and talking and, this and that. And Lee steps in the doorway, and I'm right behind him. And suddenly there's complete silence. all the bodybuilders turn towards Lee.
He's
how you guys doing? And he walked by them went into the tanning room. It was a really funny scene how they all stopped. Like here's the king entering, We got to, give him some respect,
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think – I mean, there might have been a couple of years, maybe in 1990 when they drug tested it. He wasn't at his best that year. So maybe you could argue that maybe one or two guys could have beat him that year.
Well, that was the year that I think I told you. Beat him in the pre-judging.
Yeah.
He actually beat him that year.
And I think the year before, too, in Rimini, Italy, when he was a little heavy, I think, that year. But I don't know. I mean, I look at the pictures of him. He's just so – his structure, he's just – I mean, as good as Labrada was, in Italy, he was twice as fast. Right. It was just you could see why he would win every year.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, here we go again. I mean, definitely one of the uncrowned Mr. Olympias.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, Lee is still in fantastic shape. He's got to be in his 60s or something. He was in great shape every time. Had a complete body, just like Chris and Samir, but he was a smaller man compared to Lee,
Yeah.
Well, in other words, it's a question where if Lee Labrada, as it was in 90, was in better condition than Lee, he still loses to Lee because Lee was just a bigger man.
Yeah.
So that's the way it worked, unfortunately. Yeah. That's the way it worked,
All right. Well, after the Lee Haney years, we go to – and another thing I want to mention, too, they always think, that they would always give it to the incumbent Mr. Olympia, and I think that grew more after Lee Haney's years. But like I said, with Lee, I think he kind of deserved it. So it wasn't like where Arnold, I don't know, maybe like 72, Arnold could have lost, but it was almost like the same thing with Arnold. And I don't know why the judges or the federation felt like that was important. I think the way they do it today, we were talking about this earlier. Now they take it away from the guy. If he doesn't deserve it, he'll lose. And then somebody else will win. And then the guy might be able to win it back like Jay Cutler did again. So it's way more exciting. And I think it would have been more exciting back then, too. Can you imagine if Arnold would have lost in 72? the fight they would have had in 73, because Sergio definitely would have came back in 73 if he would have won it in 72, you know.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, it's just there's a lot of great scenarios of what it could have been.
Yeah.
But I think, like I said, with Lee, I think he deserved every title. So, I mean, but he did win an 8 in a row, and then it seemed like every guy after him, they would win it until they retired. And I think even Sean Ray once, when he was losing to Dorian, he said, you know, once the guy's Mr. Olympia, he could come out of a wheelchair, and they're still going to give it to him, you know, because it doesn't matter, because he's the incumbent Mr. Olympia. He's not.
I asked Sean about that, my theory about the – he totally agreed with me.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, he's the guy who's considered the winner unless somebody steps up, or unless Mr. Olympia is a little bit out of shape, noticeably, not a little, like Arnold would, noticeably out of shape, and the other guys are in great shape or improve, then he loses. But if he, let's say, maintains his winning look, so to speak, and gets just a little bit better, he wins.
Even if he's not better. I mean, they always had that stupid saying, you got to knock the champ out, which isn't boxing. You shouldn't have to knock him out. If he deserves to lose, he deserves to lose, right?
Right. I know it's stupid, but it's something that's been passed on. It's like eating egg whites. You know, bodybuilders think you need to eat. And you know, when you say to them, why are you eating egg whites? Well, because everybody else eats egg whites.
Yeah.
Nobody ever questioned it. It's the same thing. You got to knock the champ. Nobody ever really thinks about why that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that is one of the improvements with the Mr. Olympia over the last few years, is they don't do that anymore, you know.
No, but I think that the size, the freaky size thing, definitely should be attributed to Dorian. Dorian's the one who started the
monster look. That's the next year I want to talk about, was Dorian, yeah.
Dorian started the monster look. You had guys like, now, you know, suddenly you had guys like Nasser and some Elson Body.
Yeah.
And some of the other guys, I can't even remember them offhand. He started getting these huge monsters on Gene Paul.
Folks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, gigantic guy. Jeez, I remember the first time I saw him.
Yeah.
I think it was in Columbus at one of the Arnold shows. I was standing there backstage with Bill Graham, and this guy walks up, Jean-Pierre Fuchs, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I should know his name. He's a subscriber to my plan.
Anyway,
he's a great guy. Jean-Pierre. He walked up, and I remember looking at him with Bill. I said, my God, who is this guy? Hey, look at the size of this guy.
Yeah.
And then he started posing right in front of me and Graham, and he had this gigantic back with muscle.
Yeah, huge back,
He had these huge calves. And, you know, he didn't speak much English back then, but I remember saying to him, I said, you are definitely going to be Mr. Olympia very soon, I told him, you know. And you know the rest. Unfortunately, he didn't have some bad luck happen to the guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, but he was, I mean, I use an example because, I mean, these guys are really big.
Yeah.
That's what started with the Dorian thing. I mean,
So the first year Dorian won, he was about the same size, I guess, as Lee Haney. He was probably like 240 something.
What are you talking about when he, that was not, that would be 90, wasn't it?
92. 91.
Was it 92?
In Helsinki, Finland.
Oh, no, I'm talking. Oh, I thought you went when the last year that Haney could be 91.
Oh, that was 91, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. He was not much bigger than Lee.
Yeah.
You know, they could have gone either way.
And even the next year, I think from 91 to 92, he was better. He was, you know, he had better color, better posing. He was a little more refined, but he was pretty much about the same size. I don't think he was much bigger.
I'll tell you a funny story about that 91 Olympia. You know, remember, he had first come on the kind of big bodybuilding scene at the Night of the Champions the year before. That's where I met Dorian Yates.
Yeah.
And he lost to Benazizo. All right. He lost to Benazizo. Another example of a smaller guy beating a bigger guy.
Yeah.
But Benazizo was another freak, huge amount of size. Anyway, so he shows up in 91. And I remember I think it was right before the pre-judging, I'm walking through the contest, the hotel lobby. And one of the IFBB judges walks up to me, maybe not a judge, an official. He walks up to me and he says, Jerry, he says, there's going to be a new Mr. Olympia crowned tonight. I said, wait a minute. You think that somebody's going to beat Lee Haney? Because remember, Lee had already won 7 Mr. Olympia titles.
Yeah.
To my mind, he was unbeatable.
Right.
And I said, are you talking about Yates? He says, I'm not mentioning any names. He says, well, watch and see. So, you know, when the curtain opened, you know, I and there, sure enough, I'm looking at, you know, Lee Haney, I'm looking at Dorian, and from the front, I'm seeing that Dorian is comparable in size, not bigger than Lee, but, you know, not looking small by any means, but he looks considerably harder.
Yeah.
He had a harder looking physique. I mean, not that Lee looked off, but no, I mean, Dorian looked really like hard as rock.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, holy shit, maybe it's, and I turned to Don Ross, who was sitting next to me. I said, hey, Don, I think Lee might lose. I said, look at this guy Yates. I said, he's hard as a rock. You know, Don was always into muscle definite. He says, yeah. I says, I think you could be right, you know. But then, then they started judging. I think this is the pre-judging.
Yeah.
And they turned to the back. And you know, Dorian had a great back, don't get me wrong. But Lee had that unbelievable back. And that particular year, later on, a year or two later, Dorian's back improved more.
Yeah.
But in 91, his back wasn't as great as Haney. And,
right.
Again, I turned to Don. I said, you know what? Lee's going to win it again. Look at the back comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
That's when I knew that Lee had won that year.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah, so now with Dorian, there was a couple of years there where he could have lost, right? He won it six times in a row, but he had some injuries.
Oh, yeah.
The one year he tore his bicep right before the contest, and Sean
Well,
Ray, I thought, could have beat him.
I don't forget whether it was 96 or 97 when he was competing against Nasser El-Samady.
97, that was his last year.
97, I was standing backstage, you know, and I was when they were doing the comparisons there, and you know, right, they were literally like 7 feet away from me, and I'm kind of looking at it from a side angle, but I noticed that El-Samady actually literally destroyed Dorian from the side.
Yeah.
His leg bicep was like three times bigger than Dorian's. He had comparable calf development. And, you know, when they turned to the back, by that time I kind of moved to the front. Yeah, sure, Dorian had a great back. But, you know, Nasser's was good enough where it was comparable to Dorian's. And I felt because, you know, he had that obvious, was it a bicep or tricep tear? I can't remember, Dorian, I'm talking about.
Bicep.
And also his lat looked off. One of his lats looked like it had a tear. So to me, Dorian, as great as he was not at his best. And you know, if there were points, I would have given it to Nasser about 2 points above Dorian. I would have had Nasser El-Samady win that year.
Yeah.
So yeah.
If we look back at how the judges used to judge, where symmetry was so important and, you know, all those aspects of body length, posing, if they would have used those criteria, do you think Dorian should have won the Olympia at all?
Oh, you mean as far as symmetry and all that?
Yeah.
I think he deserved most of his wins. Not maybe the last two, three years are open to question.
Yeah.
But the first couple of years, I think he deserved to win. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because he was in great condition. I mean, he was always in fantastic condition.
But I think Dorian, more than anyone, when they start talking about that incumbency factor and winning every year, even if he's a little off, I think his era kind of epitomized that because
absolutely, oh yeah,
he was off a few times and should have lost, and he kept winning.
Well, you know how you can tell, John. You know how when they first start the contest, you know they bring out the bodybuilder. Remember that they have the first comparisons.
Yeah,
most of the years that Dorian competed. When they brought out, let's say, the probable top six right off the bat, you know, Dorian and Nat, all these other guys, Lee LeBron, whoever's in it, they tell them to step back, and Dorian wasn't called back again.
Yeah, right.
Until maybe much later, when he'd be compared to a guy like Lee LeBron or Nasser, who were obviously in the top three. But most of the time, he stood back watching. That's how you knew that he'd already kind of had the edge.
Yeah.
He's already ahead of the other guys. In the judges' points, he was already the winner.
Right. All right. What should we call the era after Dorian? Would it just be the mass monster era? I mean, Ronnie was the next era.
Yeah.
Ronnie won it eight times.
Yeah, just really big guys. Ron Coleman. Yeah. You have.
I mean, then it really got freaky. I mean, Dorian was freaky, but yeah. Let's look at the weights. I mean, I think Lee Haney was pretty much in the 240s. He might have been 250, I think, for his last one.
Yeah, I saw him weigh at the Olympia in LA in 80. Was it 88?
Yeah.
Oh, they actually weighed him on stage.
Yeah, he was like 247 or something.
Yeah, and he was the heaviest guy in the show.
He weighed
47, just like you said.
Yeah.
Some of the guys were surprising, like Rich Gasparri, who was telling everybody he weighed 220, weighed 205.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
But then when you get to Dorian, I think he, like I said, he was like 240. And then the next year, the second year, he was 257. He was 15 pounds heavier.
Right.
And then after that, I think he went up to 270.
Right.
So, I mean, this was obviously the moment they had the growth hormone and the insulin coming in. And that's when you could see the size totally changed.
That's what changed the picture in bodybuilding. That's what changed the bodybuilding landscape. Those three drugs, the steroids, growth hormone, insulin, that's what caused these guys to balloon up to over 270 pounds. That's what did it right there.
Right.
That's the real secret. That's what
then you had. So then Ronnie comes in 1998. Now, I remember he was around, I think he was 247 also when he won his first time in 98. And I remember 1 year later, he was 10 pounds heavier. He was 257. But I think those were the two best years of Ronnie's reign was 98, 99.
Right.
And then I think in 2000, his third win, I think he was up to about 260.
Yeah.
I remember the judges were telling him, you're starting to get a little big, you're starting to get a little heavy, you know?
Yeah.
And then that 1 year he came in, he was 287, I think.
Yeah. That's when he started to get the big stomach sticking out.
Yeah, he was incredible. I mean, now it's almost like they're space monsters. You know, they're like from UFOs or something. I mean, it's just like they don't even look human anymore.
Well, in between you had Jay Cutler, who was a big guy.
Yeah, Jay Cutler was after Ronnie, yeah.
A very thick guy. Well, you know, the interesting thing is that one guy who beat Jay Cutler, who's, what's his name again? The guy
Dexter. Who,
Dexter. Dexter was kind of a hybrid.
Yeah, he was a little smaller,
When you think about it, Dexter started out, and I was surprised when I learned this, he started out like a featherweight.
Bantamweight, yeah.
Yeah, a bantamweight. When he started bodybuilding, he was a little guy.
Yeah.
He just put on size. This is a guy who best described as a kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
He had a little man's structure, but he developed muscles big enough to win Mr. Olympia. And of course he was very symmetrical. He had a great physique, but he was kind of like a foretelling of some of the guys that would win years later, like Brandon Carr and some of these other guys or especially Sean Rohn, another guy who I always called a hybrid.
Yeah.
He had that kind of more of a lift physique. I mean, big enough to win, but he didn't have that monstrous Coleman Cutler look.
Yeah.
But still had, you know, he had such a great looking physique that I really believed. I remember commenting at the time. I said, he just set the standard. I said, thank God they're going back to a more symmetrical, better line physique that's more appealing to most, not just the bodybuilder, but the public. I mean, the bodybuilders liked Sean Rohn. They thought he was good enough. But I mean, this is the type of physique that would be more, let's say, universally appealing. And then, unfortunately, it veered right back to the mass monsters. That's the way it is today. It's right back where have guys like this, Nick Walker. And I'm not trying to put Nick Walker down. I don't know him personally, but he's just a very massive looking physique. And some of these other guys, there's this one new guy. I wrote his name down. What's the name of that guy with the giant legs? I can't remember. Is it Rubiel Mascara?
Oh yeah, the new guy. Yeah,
this is one of the freakiest guys I've ever. What was that? Anyway, this is one of the freakiest guys I've ever seen.
Me too.
Because I've been in bodybuilding.
I mean,
you know, if this guy says he had 47 inch thighs, I'd believe it. Seriously, you see the size of that guy's legs?
Yeah, yes.
As a throwback, he's got this gigantic neck.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't see that. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
I mean, this guy's a real freak.
Yeah.
But to me, again, I mean, I don't know the man personally. He's probably a great guy. But, geez, I find his physique repelling looking.
I do too, yeah.
Oh, he's got a horrible looking. I mean, his legs are like balloons. Jeez.
Yeah.
I mean, the symmetry is so off.
Yeah.
This guy is a textbook example of the worst symmetry you could possibly have.
No.
To me, a guy like that, as you know, even though he's definitely a mass monster, he could never win the Olympia. He could never win the.
Yeah.
No, not against the guy with a symmetrical physique. This guy should. I have the same criticism for a couple of years with Big Ramey.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, Big Ramey had legs just completely overdeveloped, if you remember.
Yeah.
His legs were so, his thighs were so overdeveloped that even though he had fairly decent calves, his calves looked like sticks.
Yeah.
Because his thighs were so big.
Yeah.
Finally, he started working with Chris Aceto or somebody, and they convinced him to let his, you know, reduce his thighs a little bit. What happens? He wins the Olympia twice. See? So, you know, these guys got to take a better look at themselves and realize, you know, they need to refine their physique a little bit more if they want to win.
We skipped a couple of guys. What do you think? What do you think of Jay Cutler and Phil Heath as the Mr. Olympia champion?
Well, Jay Cutler was in, when he was in shape, was a fantastic, got completely, you know, full physique. I mean, Jay Cutler, in a way, reminds me of Larry Scott in the sense that he had bodybuilding flaws that if you took a really close look at him, like he had a really thick waist, you know, which normally is a detriment to prefer. But because he built his shoulders were so wide and his back was so wide that you didn't even notice that he had a thick waist.
Yeah.
He had pretty good abdominals for a guy that big. He had huge legs. And he, again, another guy who was very conditioned, had a good back, you know, great delts. You know, he was.
Did you think his waist was too wide?
I think it was a little too wide.
Yeah.
But that, I don't think he could help. I think that was just his structure.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, do you think he was a worthy Mr. Olympia by having the wide?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he definitely, because the amount of muscle he built on the rest of his body definitely.
Plus, he was so wide. I mean, his shoulders were so wide, you know, even if he did have a wider waist.
Well, that's my point. You didn't even notice his wide waist because his shoulders were wide.
Right.
You know, I mean, Vince Guaraldi years ago used to tell guys, you know, if they had a naturally wide waist, to do everything they can to try and build up the lateral delts.
Yeah. Like Larry Scott.
Yeah, exactly. That'll give the impression of a wider shoulders where it'll actually make you look like you have a smaller waist, you know.
Right.
That was you know, he was a good example of that, Jay.
What about Phil Heath?
Well, Phil Heath was a phenomenal bodybuilder. I mean, this is a guy who, when he was a basketball player, for crying out loud, he looked like he could compete in bodybuilding already. He had deltoid development. He had calves.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who, if there was anyone born to be a professional bodybuilder, it's Phil Heath.
Yeah. But
I would call Phil Heath, I would say, probably the second most genetically gifted bodybuilder to Sergio Oliva in bodybuilding history.
Yeah, just, I agree.
And let me tell you, let me explain why I say that. It's not just his appearance. Well, it is his appearance, of course, but it's the way is that this guy does a lot of things wrong. I mean, I have nothing against Bill Heath personally, but if you look at his training videos, the way he does his exercises, if anybody trained like Phil Heath, they would look terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, in one video, he was describing his deltoid routine, shoulder routine. He did four kinds of front press.
Right.
He did three kinds of front raises.
Yeah.
They all work the front delt.
Yeah.
I mean, when you do bench presses and flies, you're getting a lot of front delt work.
Right.
I mean, if an average guy did that, he would get an overdeveloped front delt, and his side rear delts would look like crap.
Yeah.
But Phil Heath, because of his great genetics, he gets away with it.
Yeah.
And when he did his arms, he did all these little short movements that, you know, wouldn't really produce great arms on anybody.
Yeah, incredible arms.
Phil Heath says, well, had great, fantastic arms.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, he didn't, I mean, I don't think he did much for his forearms were humongous looking.
Oh, huge, yeah.
So Phil Heath, again, I think they used to call him the gift or something like
that.
I mean, he really was a genetic, he's a genetic freak. I mean,
yeah.
I think he would admit it himself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he has said that on occasion. So,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
He's definitely, Phil Heath's problem is a problem that's plagued a lot of other bodybuilders where they get it through their heads. In other words, they kind of have noticed how to continue to win the Mr. Olympia, you have to show the best plan is to show some improvement every year. I think I told you that Arnold's philosophy, a lot of people don't know this, Arnold had this philosophy that once you reached the, let's say, the pinnacle of bodybuilding where you're at the level of a Mr. Olympia winner, you can't completely change your physique from year to year because you've already practically maximized your muscle.
Yeah.
But what you can do is look at certain muscles that maybe not be at their maximum and prove them. Now, Arnold, for example, used the example of forearms. His forearms were a little on the weak side. He felt if he increased his forearm size enough, somehow the judges would notice it, and they'd say, oh, look, Arnold's improved. He wins the Mr. Olympia again.
Yeah.
And Phil Heath, I think, knew about that or saw the way it worked. And in his mind, to continue to win the Mr. Olympia, and he did win it seven times, right? Was it seven times?
Yes.
Yeah, that he needed to make some sort of improvement. Now, way he went wrong is he, you know, the man is what, 5'7", 5'8", something like that?
5'9", I think.
All right. Yeah, he started to get to the point where he was starting to hold too much muscle. This is the same problem with Nick Walker. In other words, he has almost too much muscle for his frame.
Right.
So it makes him look like a square block.
Yeah.
It kills the symmetry. And the same goes for Phil. His symmetry was still great, don't get me wrong, but he started to get the problem as he tries to get bigger and bigger, he started to get this bloated abdomen thing.
Yeah.
And that's what finally knocked the king off the throne. He just couldn't control his abdomen.
Yeah, the abs, yeah.
And that's why he lost to Sean Roden.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if
he had it for a couple of years, too. It wasn't just the year he lost to Sean Roden, I think.
Yeah. I mean,
Phil, and it's interesting you mentioned that, too, Jerry, because Phil was the first one where they started taking it away from. Well, actually, I think it was Jay, because Jay lost. Where, you know, they before it was, you know, when you had Haney, when you had Ronnie, when you had Dorian, it was like they just kept going until they quit. They didn't lose until they quit, but they took it away from Jay after a couple of years.
Now, here's an interesting to think about this, that in regard to this, John. Think about it. You're into the history of bodybuilding also.
Yeah.
How many times did you see an elite champion bodybuilder with a bloated ab before, let's say, the 90s? How many times, let's say, in the 80s and 70s, Arnold's day, or even way back to the 60s, how many times did you see a bodybuilder standing on stage where, in a resting state, his abs, his belly stuck out like a pregnant woman?
Except for Mensah, if you believe Arnold.
Okay, yeah, well, Mensah's abdomen was like that for a reason. I think we talked about the way he worked his abs. But, I mean, I believe, and, people would argue with this, I think the ascension of this bloated abdomen look happened to occur at the same time the bodybuilder started adding a lot of insulin and growth hormones.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I think it's directly related. Because at one point, I don't remember what year it was, probably sometime during the 90s, almost everybody on the stage had a bloated abdomen. Some worse than others. They all had bellies.
Yeah.
And when they turned to the side, it was the weirdest look. I mean, you guys standing there, when they flexed their abs, they had these deep six-pack abs.
Yeah.
And they were like, boom, their belly stuck out.
They have improved that as far as the judging goes, too. I mean, I was just at a pro show this weekend, actually, in Tampa. Yeah. And there were some guys there, huge, huge guys with the stomachs, the stomach. Yeah. But I don't think you're going to get in the top five of Mr. Olympia if you got that now.
No, what happened? Well, you know what happened?
You better control it on stage, otherwise they're going to mark it.
See, what happened was it got out of hand.
It did, yeah.
I thought it was one or two guys, maybe Yates. And then after a while, you got every guy in the lineup.
Everybody, right.
The belly.
They weren't even marking guys down for it.
No, they weren't marking there. And then Arnold, in an interview, talks about how stupid the bloated belly looks, and that's when it really, they started to crack down on it.
Yeah.
And they were like, they were threatening, they were going to take points off, but a lot of the guys, this is really the ironic part. You'll notice that when they guys, even with the bloated bellies, when they even feel heat, when they flexed, their bellies disappeared. They got a flat abdominal look.
Yeah.
Somebody must have taken the bodybuilder inside, maybe one of their coaches or whoever, who was more aware, and said, listen, guy, when you're standing there and not being judged, don't, keep your abs semi-flexed.
Yeah.
Don't relax your abs. And just like back in the days when I was competing, a lot of the guys, when they're standing in the lineup, would relax their legs, and their legs would look smooth.
Yeah.
Vince LeGrande is the one who taught me. He says, when you're standing there, keep your legs slightly flexed so they look more muscular than the other guys, and it'll give you an edge. And I did all the contests I competed in. So somebody, I believe, got to these guys, because as you say, they probably some of the guys still have bloated bellies.
Oh, yeah, they do, for
and
sure.
And John, it's unavoidable. If you're taking those drugs,
yeah,
It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. Other than
everybody's taking those drugs.
That's what I'm saying. So the only way to avoid it is to stand there with your abs. I mean, you don't have to flex them really hard. But yeah. You got to like try and do a semi-vacuum if you can. Most of these guys can't do a vacuum. But if you do a semi-vacuum and keep your abs slightly flexed, then it gives the impression that they don't, their bellies aren't bloated. I think,
but a lot of them can do vacuums now. Like Derek Lunsford can do that. Hottie,
It's kind of coming back. Well, all the classic bodybuilders—that's like a standard pose for them.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I mean,
yeah.
this guy who won. What's his name? The guy who's won 6 years in a row.
Bumstead.
That's one of his main poses. He does.
Yes, vacuum.
So that's common in that. So it's kind of coming back. It's kind of the anti-bloat look.
Exactly. Right.
The idea is that if you can do a vacuum, then you probably don't have a bloated belly. You know what I mean?
Right.
A mute way of saying, look at me, I don't have a bloated belly. I can do a vacuum, you know?
Yeah.
So it's coming back, you know?
So, I mean, this is a kind of a hard question to answer, but if we look at the 60 years of the Mr. Olympia, Jerry, what's your overall thoughts, you know?
Well, it goes, it's like things being in style.
Yeah.
I mean, like clothes. I mean, for a couple of years, I go way back in time for this one. Like in the 70s, a lot of people were wearing what they call bell-bottom pants.
Yeah, bell-bottom pants. Yeah.
You know, or then later on it was skinny jeans, all this kind of stuff. And then they go out of style, you know, and then you might get different, completely different. And then a couple of years later, what happens? The bell-bottom jeans suddenly
right.
And that's the way kind of bodybuilding contests have been over the decades. You have these big guys, and then it goes start to slip towards where you have more symmetrical cut guys like Samir and Chris. And then it starts to slip back with Dorian into size. And, you know, and so where it ends, I don't know. You know, all I know is that I personally, I've mentioned this in past podcasts with you, I have a little misgivings about the current state of pro bodybuilding because the emphasis is on so much size now.
Yeah.
And I know what these guys do to get that size. Yes, they train hard. Yes, they do good nutrition. But it's not. Let's put the cards on the table and not be deceitful. A lot of it's the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, these guys taking more and more drugs. I've come across a lot of studies recently about some of the effects of drugs, particularly one called Trenbolone. I just did an article in my Applied Metabolics about the and the effects of Trenbolone shocked even me. These guys have no idea what they're in for if they keep using this stuff. I don't even want to say it out loud, but I just hope these guys fare well in the future because they're doing a lot of things now that can only be called suicidal to get ready for shows. And I would personally, because of that, I'd like to see a regression, if you want to call it that, back to maybe a Sean Roden type of physique where, meaning you're big, and symmetrical, but you're not bloated out. And you look like your muscle fits your body structure.
Yeah.
That's the way I think a Mr. Olympia should look.
What's your favorite era of the Mr. Olympia over the 60-year span? A certain time period.
I would have to be the Arnold years.
The Arnold years, okay.
Even though it was the Olympia was sparsely populated, as you point out.
Yeah.
There was something. I mean, it was kind of exciting, you know, to get the magazines and see all the photos of Arnold, all the other guys, and Arnold, and you know the fact that I saw him every day in the gym and stuff.
Yeah.
It added an extra dimension to me that I actually knew the guys personally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like today, you know, I don't know any of the guys. The only guys who know me are guys who competed in the 90s, Dorian and those guys. The new guys wouldn't know me from Adam.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the old days when I used to go to all the major contests. You know, so I personally. For no other reason than health reasons, I'd like to see bodybuilding kind of go back a little bit to the not necessarily the Samir Chris look, but at least the Sean Roden look. You know what I mean? Where
I agree. Yeah.
I guess the word I would use a more plausible physique.
Yeah.
Rather than complete freak physique, but you know I know my words are going to fall on deaf ears because as Wayne D'Amelio pointed out to me. The hardcore bodybuilding fans want to see freaks. He's right. He's right. They love guys like Nick Walker.
Yeah.
It's very exciting to see a monster like that come out on stage. I mean, because they, you know, one of the reasons is they know they can never look like Nick Walker.
Mm-hmm.
most of the people that watch Nick Walker compete, or you know, or even Dorian, they're looking at this guy. I know I could never live, but it's almost like looking at the comic books.
Yeah,
people love Superman. They know they're not going to, you know, be able to leap over a tall building in one leap or fly through the sky.
Yeah,
but they still love the fantasy of Superman, and they like to see a guy like Nick Walker. They enjoy the fantasy of thinking, gee, imagine if I were that big.
Yeah.
So they kind of, you know, it's like when we were kids, you know, I'm sure you went through this, you know, going to the contest, you see, they say, wow, I want to look like that guy.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's a lot of the mentality.
I don't know if the fans today want to look like those guys. I think they just.
Oh, no. No,
they appreciate it, but I don't think they want to look like them.
No, you're right. No, they don't want to look like, because they can't. They know they can't look like him.
But I think they wanted to look like Arnold. They wanted to look like Larry. Yeah. They wanted to look like Frank Zane.
Well, that's one of the attractions of people like Frank Zane, because it's a completely attainable physique.
Even a guy like Arnold was bigger. I think a lot of people wanted to look like that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But today, it's more of a curiosity thing than anything else. In other words, the freakish look, it's like a fantasy thing. They it's kind of like you want to the fans want to see just how big these guys can get.
Yeah.
They get turned on by that.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's not good for the bodybuilder themselves, because they're putting themselves at great risk.
Right.
I mean, I know if I said any of this to them in person, they'd say, hey, Jerry, go fuck off, you know?
Yeah,
and they're not going to listen. They wouldn't care. They want to win. You know, you got a mentality where, you know, like, you remember that famous statement years ago, what was it, Tom Platz, where he said if you won the Mr. Olympia and dropped dead 2 days later, you'd be happy.
Yeah.
That's the mentality of these guys. I mean, you can't get through to them. But it's not going to work until it actually happens. Then it's too late.
I think my favorite era was the 80s, because I think the physiques were more advanced then, and I think the posing was better. And I think that's when they were posing more to music in the 80s. And then they weren't freaky big. Like you said, at 88, you had Gaspari at 205. I mean, he was big, but he wasn't like a freak, you know.
Well, you had a great – I mean, you had people like Bob Parris, Rory Lederman.
They almost looked like superheroes back then. I think they were like superheroes.
Yeah, they look like, and they just had, the only word I could think of is beautiful. They had literally beautiful physique.
I think a lot of those guys back then, they kind of remind me of like our version of movie stars. You know, they were so good looking, and their physiques were so good, and they posed so, they were like works of art up there. And it was more advanced, I think, than the 70s physique. Like, of course, Arnold was the greatest, but I think most of those guys in the 70s weren't as completely developed, you know.
Right.
You know, I think the physiques were much better in the 80s, but it hadn't gone too far yet. I think in the 90s, a lot of people say the 90s were the best era because the guys were big. And I mean, you had Lavroni, you had Flex, you had Dorian, you had, you know, some really, really incredible physiques. But I think they were getting, it was too much, I think. To me, I think they were getting too big. They were getting like beyond like human size, you know.
I totally agree. And, you know, I didn't think it through, but I now have to change my opinion. You're right. I would say the 80s were the best era.
Yeah.
As you said, they had so many great-looking physiques that didn't have a freaky look, but had just a fantastic, symmetrical, beautiful appearance, these guys.
Yeah.
That I don't think would turn off anybody, not even somebody into bodybuilding.
Right.
In fact, I'd been at contests back then. I remember where I was at the show where Bob Parris won the Nationals. What was that, 81? I can't remember.
83.
I was there, and I heard the comments of people watching the show.
Yeah.
And some of them were obviously not bodybuilders. I heard women, you know, I didn't know these people. They were looking at Bob Parris, and I heard them say, who is that guy?
Yeah.
And the guy who was with him obviously knew who Bob was, was a bodybuilding fan.
Yeah.
He'd say, oh, that's Bob Parris. He probably is going to win. And the woman would say something like, gee, he's such a good look. I love the way he looks. You know,
Jerry, I remember going to shows, local shows in Chicago in the 80s, and you would always see groups of girls, women, you know, like four or five girls. And they would go to the bodybuilding shows to see the men, because the men were so attractive to them. You know, they liked that muscular, but they weren't too big. They weren't freaky. They were good looking guys with muscles.
Yeah.
It was almost like them going out to the strip show that night. You know, they went to the male strip show because they could see these guys and see their bodies. And that's how they thought of bodybuilders back then. They were attractive.
Well, I saw a couple of those kind of women at some of the major shows that I used to cover for Joe. You know, the Arnold show.
Yeah.
I'd see women show up by themselves at the show. And you know, it's obvious they really wanted to see, you know, they were turned on by these guys' physiques.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, again, that was before the days of the giant freaks. I don't think that most women would like that type of physique.
No, at all. I don't think so either.
You know, so it's kind of like, if you reverse it, it's kind of like the way bodybuilders look at gigantic female bodybuilders. You know, it's like my feeling is that as a male, I can appreciate the amount of muscle they put on and the amount of muscle definition. But, you know, I'm not at least bit attracted to them in a sexual way. Not at all.
Right.
Not one. I mean, I don't mean to be, I hope women don't get mad at me saying this, but, you know, you can't control the way your brain works. You're only attracted to certain types.
Right.
A woman has to express a certain degree of femininity. Otherwise, I'm just not turned on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
All right, Jared. Well, thank you for joining me for the last couple hours to talk about the 60 years of the Mr. Olympia. We tried to cover it as best as we could.
Yeah.
I think we gave a good overview of it.
Yeah,
so, I think so. This year, they'll be celebrating the 60th, not the 60th anniversary, but the 60th Mr. Olympia conference.
Wow, time flies. Jeez.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, are you going to go to the show, John? At the
Olympia? Yeah, I'm planning on it. Yeah, I'm planning on going this year.
Is it in Florida this time?
No, it's in Vegas.
Oh, it's back in Vegas?
Yeah.
See, I don't even keep up. I don't even know where it is.
Wow. It's at a new hotel called Resorts World.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be really nice. And it's going to be there, I think, for quite a while. I think they signed a multi-year contract. So
I like it in Vegas, though, you know?
Yeah, more exciting, yeah.
I mean, you think the Lundstrom you think he has a good chance of
I think he has a real good chance. Yeah, I just saw him last night at this Tampa show, and he's huge. He's really huge.
So he's actually put on more size.
More size, yeah, much more size. Yeah,
so all he has to do is harden it up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll probably win again. But Heidi's also gotten a little bit bigger. I saw a recent show.
Yeah, he's very hard. So,
geez, that's going to be a pretty good show, you know? A couple of guys.
Yeah.
A couple of new guys, too, you know, that we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll talk about it for sure.
I think it'll probably be a pretty competitive show. Unless, unless Lunsford looks so freakish that he turns into one of those things where, you know, they ask him to step back and jump.
Yeah, right. I think it's going to be very, very tight.
Won't know till it happens.
Yeah.
All right, John.
All right, Jared. Well, thank you again for joining me on the show. It's always a pleasure having you on. And Applied Metabolics, of course, is your newsletter. I'll put the link below. If anyone wants to subscribe, it's only $10 a month.
Right.
I appreciate you coming on again, Jer.
Okay, John. Take care. And we'll be talking again, I'm sure.
Okay. Sounds good. Take care, Jer. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Brainham for joining us for the last three episodes. I always appreciate having Jerry on the show. And if you haven't already, check out Jerry's newsletter, appliedmetabolics.com. Jerry works very hard on this. I think it's like 35, 40 pages each month. His newsletter is really, really long, and it comes out once a month. It's only $10 a month. So if you want to support Jerry for all he does for the show, then check out his newsletter, appliedmetabolics.com. All right. Now I want to read this article, Once Upon a Time in Australia, that was sent to me by Michael Ecclemides. And Michael has his own website, too. It's at vintagebodybuildingmags.com. And I went on there today and looked at it. And he's got a ton of articles in there about the 1980 Olympia. So if you guys are looking for something good to read, check out Michael's website, vintagebodybuildingmags.com. Michael sent this to me and it said, the spotlight this month continues with the theme of the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest. What is presented below is an anonymous piece of bodybuilding literature penned in 2015 for a select group that was aptly titled Once Upon a Time in Australia. I first heard about this article about half a dozen years ago, and I did everything I could to find a copy of it to read. I had no success, and I put it down to another mythical bodybuilding rumor. However, through the luck of a chain of fortunate events, I have not only read, but I've also been granted consent to share this editorial of opinion, supported by factual events, on this website. As for the anonymous author that penned the piece, all I will say is he is as qualified as anyone to cast an opinion. This is no keyboard warrior that hides behind a username and a profile that is far from their reality. No, the author of this piece is definitely all man and a yard wide and has rubbed shoulders, or should I say knocked elbows, with the best of them. Further, his writing style is up there with the penmanship of Rick Wayne. The article itself focuses on three key participants, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Joe Weider, and Paul Graham, All three have been considered both protagonists and antagonists to the sport of bodybuilding and the infamous 1980 Mr. Olympia. I personally think that the whole three have done so much good for the sport of bodybuilding. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Joe Weider on a global scale, and Paul Graham on the Australian scene. So please don't consider this an attack on any of those three. I present this not only not to bring these gentlemen down, but to share an important piece of bodybuilding history literature. All right, so once upon a time in Australia, an alternative view of history. Once upon a time, when I was young and naive and the world was a better place, an amazing spectacle took place in Sydney, a modern-day version of the Clash of the Titans. Only the second time in its history that the supreme crown in the bodybuilding firmament, the Mr. Olympia, would be contested outside of America. The putrefying albatross of this contest still hangs from the neck of those that allowed this disgraceful episode in the history of bodybuilding to take place, to forever sully, besmirch, tarnish, and stain its reputation, which it could ill afford to lose and perhaps never fully recover from. On that day in October 1980, romance, realism, and truth met on the stage of the Sydney Opera House. Romance and truth did not just lose, they died on that day. Some might even suggest they were executed, some assassinated, others sacrificed on the altar of expedience, as nothing could be left to chance or be left to stand in the way of the triumphant return of the demigod. There have been countless attempts by various amnesis to cunningly and deviously conflate many different stories, Mephistophelian-like, in their efforts to divert us from the truth on this matter. Even to this very day, they are hard at work. Wikipedia displays an extremely good example by some of their ongoing efforts to convince us that this was, in fact, a real contest. Many fans walked away that evening in Morlock ignorance, completely unaware that what they had just witnessed was not, in fact, a bodybuilding contest at all, but an act torn from a grubby, well-thumbed page of a much-used WWF playbook. I was already resigned to laconic equanimity because I understood only too well that the last grains of sand were already in the neck of the glass before this sordid charade had ever begun. It was able to begin on the day that Mr. Olympia was awarded to the Australian president when a whole raft of favors was finally able to be repaid. Act One was played out in sunny California sometime in 1973. There had been a long-running battle between Uncle Joe and Dan Lurie over who could claim the top dog position in America. They had been fighting over, in effect, who owned what bodybuilder and the rights and choices of bodybuilders to appear in both antagonist magazines and contests. A battle by Dan, driven by passion and a true love of one of the world's oldest activities known to mankind, and the other antagonist driven by a naked lust for power that more resembled the actions of a potentate of the medieval age. And to be fair to Dan Lurie, most of this nonsense was coming from Uncle Joe's camp. Some years before, Dan had thrown down the gauntlet by publishing an open letter to Joe via his magazine. In it, he had challenged Joe to prove once and for all who was the better man. Dan was of the opinion that many of the claims made by the self-titled Master Blaster were less than truthful. In plain English, he was doubting the veracity of most, if not all, of Joe's claims. Claims that included bodybuilding titles and weightlifting records, amongst others. Although the gauntlet remained on the ground, ignored and untouched, Joe never forgot. He would have his day. He would have his revenge for the attempt by a mere mortal at public humiliation. To many, there's no better joy than that of Schadenfreude. Joe finally hit upon the strategy of using a disciple in the form of his prized possession and star pupil, Arnold S. He would be the one that would bring the lawsuit that would financially cripple and bankrupt Dan out of the game, leaving the field free for the Weider Empire to expand and for the myth of the father of world bodybuilding and the Weider Research Clinic to take root without having to sully his own hands. One does not need to be a reader of Sherlock Holmes to deduce that this litigation was fully funded, if not by the litigant, but by Weider himself. And although Arnold had learned a valuable life lesson on how to shaft an opponent, the favor or debt would remain for him to draw down later. So began a marriage of convenience that would be consummated, unlike most, in full view of the public. Act Two, strange as it may seem, happened sometime before this episode. Paul Graham and Arnold's relationship goes back some way to when Arnold first moved to the States, almost penniless, as he has claimed. He was befriended by Paul, who is no stranger to the art of the scam or spin, but a complete stranger to any form of integrity, who offered him and his little mate the opportunity to make a little extra loot on the side. Paul had a love of cars, other people's cars. Most of all, he loved Corvettes. And he'd built a network across the country to borrow and then move cars interstate. For this, he needed drivers. Sadly, as is always the case, every good scam must come to an end. It was time for Paul and his ill-gotten gains to take steps, big ones, and leave town and head off back to the safety of Sydney. Unfortunately, this part of his life ended in tears. He and the bag of loot were intercepted at the airport. With 1 foot on the staircase leading to a better life, it was not to be. As it is a federal offense in America to borrow other people's cars without their consent and then drive them over state lines, Paul spent a leisurely 2 years in San Quentin. During that period of his incarceration, he received a number of visitors, one of them being none other than Arnold. If you're lucky enough to get your hands on a copy of the first print of the book Pumping Iron, you'll see a picture of Arnold in the exercise yard of the penitentiary. On Paul's eventual return to Sydney, he ennobled himself with the titles Australia's Strongest Man, Mr. Australia, and Mr. Universe, a fine example of the veracity and nature of the man. At his last tilt, quixotic like a genuine title, the Mr. Australia of 73 held on the Gold Coast, he failed miserably, collapsing unheroically in a toilet stall, even before the prejudging had begun, never to attempt to contest a genuine title again. So at this point, we now have another of the Troika being owned a small favor. A grubby little daisy chain is beginning to form. Let's recapitulate for a moment. Joe is in Arnold's debt, but Arnold now owes Paul a matzah. When would the stars align so that all three can collect their pound of flesh? It would happen soon. It would happen when Paul Graham was awarded the honor of staging the most prestigious contest in the bodybuilding world for only the second time outside the confines of the USA. One can only speculate why Weider entrusted his baby to a man of dubious character. At this point, I need to add, for the sake of background, that although Paul had been voted as Australian president, he had been voted out of the office soon after at an extraordinary meeting of the ABBA. Not being a man who accepts the will of the masses, he immediately went running, sniveling, and complaining to the Weiders, who dried his tears and promptly endorsed his brand new organization and his position as president of it. That moment also marked the end of any pretense in Australia anyway that the IFBB was in any way democratic, and in turn also spawned the birth of three other national bodybuilding organizations. That schism remains to this day. This part of the saga is the most unbelievable of all. Did Arnold suddenly wake one morning after being imbued by the spirit of the Holy Ghost, or visited in his dreams by a succubus, and thus being inspired, decided that he would take one more roll of the dice, risk his legacy, reputation, and what he hoped to bequeath for one more title, for a handful of silver? When he threw the dice, were they weighted? This part of the story would insult the intelligence of an ant. 3 months, or as the Wiki fairy tale has it, 2 months preparation for the Mr. Olympia? There was some research done a number of years ago at a U.S. university in regards to how long it takes an athlete after a layoff to return to his or her previous peak. They gathered a group from a cross-section of sports and gave them all an enforced rest of 2 weeks. Their fitness levels were checked and measured pertaining to their event before and after their rest period, and thereafter every week. On average, it took them 12 weeks to return to their previous peak. Arnold had been out of competition not for 2 weeks, but for 5 years. A lifetime in an athlete's life. Arnold could not help but boast immediately that after the contest that he had defeated the cream of the crop, who had been training and preparing for this ultimate contest of contests for up to an entire year, and reserved in this period for men who had been awarded the Mr. Universe title. There were no dummies here, no morons, and no idiots, and certainly no cannon fodder to make up the numbers. No, Arnold would now have achieved his victory in just 12 weeks of training. He would now be elevated to demigod status. He had performed a miracle, not quite up to par with the water and wine trick, and defiantly below that of walking on water, but nevertheless, he would take his place in the Parthenon of the gods. What he had succeeded in concocting, perhaps unwittingly at the begging, but certainly consciously in the end, was the Thicudian trap. For all concerned, his wish had to be granted. He had transcended godlike the ultimate power of the Weiders. But how does one weigh dice? It takes time to put in place all you need for a stunt of this magnitude. Nothing could be left to chance, for one slip, one miscalculation would leave Arnold's legacy in tatters. Would this contest be, as the Duke of Wellington described the Battle of Waterloo, a close-run thing? Not on your life. The fawning judges, whose love of Arnold bordered on idolatry, were lined up, all too ready to fawn and paw once more and genuflect at the feet of him who must be worshipped, whose reputation must, at all costs, remain intact for posterity. It would be fair to add at this point that there were a couple of judges who still valued their integrity. Once they realized what the game was, they withdrew. Unfortunately, though, for those in the cheap seats, with no understanding of what was soon to unfold, they withdrew sotto voce with little publicity. Added insurance was provided by none other than Oscar State, as always the portcullis that guarded the gate to any outcome that might endanger the noble reputation of the Weider Empire. And their will, as he had done with preternatural skill and elan in saving the presidency for Brother Ben in 75, when he had lost the annual vote for head honcho of the IFBB in Pretoria to Serge Nubre. With the sleight of hand of a riverboat gambler, he had deftly recounted the ballots to ensure that Ben would continue as the head honcho, and to doubly ensure that this aberration was never repeated, the position became president for life. Serge, for his pains, would soon be banned for life on charges of appearing in blue movies, but more for the temerity and audacity of challenging for the position. The accusations leveled would have to be considered cute in the extreme, and particularly in light of the Weider's antecedents. Serge would be allowed to appear and compete at the 75 Olympia when there were only three in the contest, and then go on to establish his own organization with his honor unblemished. Whose organization was it anyway? Certainly not the people's. It was, after all, only meant to look democratic, not to be democratic, and only until the IFBB had attained one of the major goals that the Weiders yearned, full membership of the Olympic Committee. For as it is known, even dictators and despots crave legitimacy for their fiefdom. And so the stage was finally set for the last stanza, the last act in the play, the stunt of all stunts that would bring everlasting glory and fame to all that were involved. The corps de ballet obediently and unwittingly took their place. Shakespeare himself would have labored to construct a better scenario than that which was about to unfold. The contest started, as do most, with a meeting to decide whether there would be, as in the past, two weight divisions or just the one. It was decided to proceed with just one combined class, with the only dissenter being Arnold. One would have to presume that he thought the contest already in the bag, so to speak, and the pose down would look better between himself and a smaller man. At this point, the room was calm, as one would expect of contestants mentally preparing themselves before the first round. But then, behold, the fun began. Suddenly, quite out of the blue and out of context with the discussion, Arnold then blurted out an ad hominem aimed specifically at Mike Mentzer. "You'll never win an Olympia with a gut like that." Strange as it may seem, Mike took immediate offense to this attack and started to move in the direction of where Arnold had seated himself. Was this going to turn into a physical confrontation? Unfortunately, and sadly to some minds, it would not. Ben stepped in between the pair. It was obviously no accident on the part of Arnold in regards to this personal comment. A ploy, and a weak one at that, to deflect and unbalance Mike's mental preparation? As an aside, Mike would never again grace the Olympia stage and immediately after announced his premature retirement from professional bodybuilding. Like most others in the lineup, he had thought that this was a real contest, as did Frank Zane, who in complete disgust and contempt destroyed his trophy. Once upon the stage, it could be seen by those who were standing close that Arnold's pupils were dilated, and there was a sphincter clenching fear slowly radiating from his body and anxiety dripping from every pore of his body. But in actuality, he had little to fear. He had, after all, been away from competition for 5 years, and when he had last competed, there were but two other contestants. And not forgetting, the contest format had moved to a stricter, more formal process. It would no longer be the simple case of causing others to mentally disintegrate. Contestants now had strict rules to follow. That is, everybody but Arnold. Dennis Stallard from Wales had introduced the format of the compulsory poses some years before, and Sergeant Major-like had enforced them. Unfortunately, and his destiny would have it, he had been removed. Some speculate because of his strict adherence to the rules by everyone, and Arnold was given free rein to do as he pleased. The results were very much a foreseen conclusion to those who understood and had diligently read and followed by the playbook. and the only real challenge that faced the judges on that day of infamy was in what order to place the bit players, the corps de ballet, who had unwittingly taken part. The troika had been triumphant, the planning meticulous in its detail. Uncle Joe had been convinced to award the Olympia to Paul Graham the second time it had left the U.S., and in doing so, reluctantly repaying a debt to his protege. Arnold had been able to repay his outstanding account to Paul and help reignite his own public persona and movie aspirations. And Paul had been able to save this tidy sum of $50,000 U.S. in prize money. An American TV company, CBS, had traveled to Sydney to produce a documentary on this, as it was at the time an attempted comeback. They departed Australia in disgust. The documentary never saw the light of day, nor would they attend the Olympia in the future. Such was the reaction from the crowd at Arnold's acceptance speech that it was drowned out by a wall of booing that had never been accompanied any of Arnold's previous outings. A much overused word is used today, charisma. Its original meaning translates to one who is touched by God. How utterly sad and so devastating to realize that my and your hero had feet of clay. A miserable ending to the credibility and integrity of one who had once straddled the world. He who had carried the globe, Herculean-like, on his shoulders, who had literally been unbeatable at his best, and who would have on this day had he been in shape that he presented in 1974. Would all the perfumes of Arabia be able to sweeten the stink of this mess? Bear in mind that this was in time of no internet, and magazines were the only method of disseminating bodybuilding news. Many of these magazines' only real mission was to serve as the handmaidens to the egos of the weeders. To that end, the scribes obsequiously set to work to spin this tale of victory and conflate this story as best they could. They performed a wonderful job. Many of them are still to this day remorselessly spinning away. I once had a conversation with Paul Graham in regards to how he could tell barefaced lies without batting an eyelid, as it was an art that I struggled with. After pondering for a moment, he replied that he found it easy. I just repeat my version of the story a few times and it becomes the truth. Besides, people only remember the result, not what happened. So true. But he won it, didn't he, you might say? Yes, he did, but honor, integrity, and even bravery wear different coats to different eyes, and we all have choices. Postscript. So successful was this stunt, and so little a ripple did it cause, without even so much as a whimper, that the very next year it was pulled again. A one-legged man won. And the promoter, Paul Graham, would later be rewarded a special diploma for services rendered to bodybuilding, presented by none other than his friend and conspirator, Arnold. Karma, the force created by a person's actions that some people believe causes good or bad things to happen to that person. Sadly, this is patently not true in this case. Latache Nore, the black stain, would remain in the hearts of some who were involved that day. Final thoughts? I hope you enjoyed the above. I did have the pleasure of talking with the author just prior to uploading this article. We discussed some of the omissions from the article that he wanted to put on record. The first is in relation to Judges Chairman Dennis Stallard. Arnold clowned around on stage and basically did as he pleased, never once obeying the orders he posed after being told not to, and he did not complete the mandatory pose request. Dennis threatened to disqualify Arnold for his actions shortly after Dennis was removed of his duties, not to be seen again. Second, Bill Pearl nobly removed himself from the judging panel because he had spent time at his Oregon ranch coaching Chris Dickerson. Bill is bodybuilding's gentleman, and his integrity must be admired. The problem was that by not judging, his integrity was sadly missed on the judging panel. He would have been a great asset to the adjudication. Finally, the selection of the judges was made difficult by the remoteness of Australia. Most of the judges were selected beforehand to enable them to make arrangements to travel to Sydney. Paul Graham was to provide one judge. He selected Brendan Ryan when Peter McCarthy arrived late for the judges' meeting. Peter McCarthy was relegated to the role of backup judge. Frank Burwash, as chairman of judges for Australia, was shocked to be told that the only judge to represent Australia on the Olympia panel was Brendan Ryan, who had, together with Paul Graham, had been official stood down as a Nationals judges 2 months earlier. The IFBB had officially notified of this suspension at the time, and yet selected this judge for the world's greatest contest. I've attached the article by Frank Burwash titled The Olympia Fiasco that adds to the above. In defense of the IFBB, Bill Pearl, as one of his last acts as head judge, was asking all competitors if there were any complaints concerning the judges, Albert Busick from Germany, Brendan Ryan, Australia, Michael Walczak from USA, Mitz Kawashima from the USA, Reg Park from South Africa, Jacques Bloemhart from Belgium, and Dan Howard from the USA, and no one objected. All right. Great. So we finally got to read Once Upon a Time in Australia. That was very, very interesting. And of course, if you know the story of Paul Graham and Arnold and all that, a lot of that was kind of a review of what we already knew, but it was interesting to read. I think I have a good idea who wrote that piece. So that's it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that. I don't think I ever read that fully. So thank you to Michael again for sending that to us. I appreciate it. Thanks again to Jerry for joining us for the show. We will be back next week. I'm not sure if we will have a guest, but if we don't, I'll read some articles for you guys. So we will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters for helping to support the show. I couldn't do it without you. If you guys are interested in becoming a Patreon supporter of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to the official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner. And again, if you guys want to send me any emails, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, guys, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.